Grace Foss and Barry Bernard are here with me today. We're speaking, and they're both from the Mi'kmaq Legal Support Network, which is an organization that we're going to be speaking about in a moment. Before we talk about that, we wanted to mention a historic decision that happened here in the province. I wanted to ask about the Donald Marshall inquiry. What happened there?
In the 70s, a Native person from Member 2 was wrongly convicted for murder, for killing a black guy. In regards to him being in jail for 11 years, he would have been out sooner than expected, but the parole board wanted him to admit that he killed a black guy, but every time he went to the parole board, he would refuse admitting of killing this person. For the next 11 years, every year he came up to the parole board and he refused to admit because he was innocent all the way through, and this is how MLSN became to be, because of the Marshall inquiry.
As a result of it, there was quite a bit of uproar, as I'm sure you can understand, from the Aboriginal community, but also within the justice system. They came to finally recognize that there is something seriously wrong in how they process Aboriginal people, and something needed to be changed. Donald Claremont was put in the helm to go about to figure out how come this has occurred and to create some recommendations. Out of those recommendations was the decision to create the Mi'kmaq Legal Support Network. And this organization, which we represent, is primarily our role is to assist Aboriginal people as they go through the justice system to ensure that they have a fair and equitable chance.
Well, we had our own laws before the Europeans arrived here in, they call it Nova Scotia, Mi'kma'ki. We had our own justice system, and it was run by the Grand Council, and it was always also run by the whole community. The Mi'kmaq society had their own justice system. When the Europeans arrived, we introduced that we do have our own justice system. As a nation, we were also civilized, like any other nations in this world. But Europeans didn't recognize that, that we had our own justice system.
I think the difference in terms of the Western idea and the Aboriginal is can be really quite captured in a gathering that was once held where an elder was asked, so what did you do to your people when they did something wrong? And her response, she was quite agitated by this because she'd been listening all day and wanting to partake, and she said, we didn't do anything to them. We helped them. And I think that's the difference between what we know as the Western way of doing things. When someone does something wrong, we have to punish them. Within Aboriginal communities, our view is they are hurting. And when one person is hurting within a community, all are hurting. And it's a ripple effect. So we need to assist that person. And by doing that, we need to be part of the solution. And that's where we can lead really quite nicely into what services do we then provide. So we provide the customary law program. Customary law program is the ability, is a service that we take advantage of what we knew pre-European contact, which was using the circles, going back to the traditions of ensuring that if someone has done something wrong, giving them an opportunity to show the community that they're willing to make amends. It's important, though, in order for them to partake in the circle, that they acknowledge what they've done is wrong and are willing to take responsibility for it and do something to show the community. So in order to do that, they need to be surrounded by people who can support them in that role. Whoever has been offended by that individual, it's important that if they're able and willing to be present at the circle, so that would be the victim. Well, the victim needs support too, so they would have someone come with them. And in all circles in the customary law program, we always have the presence of an elder. And so an elder of the community would come forward and be part of the circle. Our circles include, at times, a judge, and that's in particular when there's a sentencing circle. But majority of the time, it will include the offender, the elder, the victim, support people for both, the facilitator, which is our staff people, as well as a co-facilitator, a community member. Possibly we may need to have, if it's a youth worker, a probation officer. If it's a federal offense, maybe a parole officer. And unfortunately, as we know, Aboriginal people do struggle with alcohol and drug problems, and which lead to them end up being convicted of a crime. So there could be an addictions counselor present as well. So that process is ultimately to, one, to acknowledge what has happened. Traditionally, that's what they did, the Mi'kmaq. But also then to identify can we move forward? How can we help this person and help the community heal? And recommendations are made. Everyone has an input. And then it's our role as MLSN to assist that individual to help to complete those recommendations. Mm-hmm. That's a circle process. In 2007-2008, we were asked to do 99 circles. And circles could have been the customary circle, restorative justice circle, or sentencing circle, a healing circle. Of all those circles, 61% of them were successful, which is very good. Really proud of that.
And so by successful, how is that determined?
That the person completed the recommendations from the circle process.
Can you give us an example of one of those cases to help illustrate what these look like? Someone who went through it, what the recommendations were, who was present at the circle, how the community responded. And
well, good one. Okay, let me tell you a good one. This summer, on my vacation for 2 weeks, on my vacation, I took four young youths that were part of the circle. One of the recommendations was to do their community hours. Out of the four of them, some of them had over 100 hours of community service. During my break, summer break, I took them to Chapel Island, an island isolated where, I don't know if you know Chapel Island, that's where we have our St. Anne's Mission. There's about over 100 cabins around this little island, and around this church, Catholic church, and there's about over 100 cabins. So I took them on the island for 2 weeks, and what we're doing, we're helping the elders, cleaning up their cabins, painting them, whatever services that we can provide to the elders. We did that for the whole 2 weeks. Some of them were making wharves, we're using all raw material. We didn't buy it, and we had to cut something down and make the wharf, like 30, 40 foot wharves out of raw material. One kid I was thinking about that had over 100 hours of community service that he needed. During that first week, I told him that they can go home on a Friday. But this kid came back on Sunday morning. He hitchhiked from Esquizonia to Chapel Island that he wanted to continue on working, and was on a Sunday. So what I was so surprised of, this poor kid that had no father figure, I think he needed a role model, like a man or, you know, some, like a brother or a big brother as a role model. And I think I filled his shoes for a while and I helped him out. But we finished over 120 hours that, at the end, I eventually gave him a couple of dollars, you know, for his services, because he overworked his 100 hours. I think he did over 140 hours. And I was really surprised, because he was a hard kid to work with in the community. But when it came down that, when I took him under my wing and introduced him to the other guys, and we just talked about his problems, and while you're isolated on an island, I think the feelings come out more, and the trust comes out, and so sometimes we take a break, we talk around the fire, you know, how come you did this, and why did you do that, how are you going to change things, and my suggestion to these young people was education was the important factor, that you have to obtain as much education as you can get to get off that system, because 99% of our people live on welfare, especially in Esquizonia. There's 4,000 people, and you can still say 95% of them live on welfare. So some of these poor kids never traveled outside their community. There's one kid that I took over 100 hours, he'd never been to a restaurant. So during that 2 weeks, We would go off, go to a restaurant. He didn't know how to order a meal. Didn't know what to do when he got to the restaurant. The food was totally foreign to him. And at the end of the 2 weeks, he just left working with us. And when we came back to Esquizoni, he came over to my house. He does the lawn for me regularly. He asks if there's any jobs around the house. I mean, from, I think it's a total 360 turn that he took. Just to be with him and just to tell him what he needs to do, just to change things, because he was stuck in that runt where there was nobody advising him what to do. He didn't have a big brother to fall back, or he didn't have somebody to tell him, you know, you need to do this and change things. And that's one of the success stories that I've seen this summer coming from MLSN.
Yeah. I think, and on that note, when you talk about he recognized that someone took an interest in him and really was there to support him, that is what the court worker program is about. What we know is, like I said earlier, the idea of a court can be pretty scary to most anyone within the population, but it's very something quite foreign to the Aboriginal client, and it's the process can be so intimidating that it's you get in and you admit to anything as long as you get out of there pretty quick. And so the court worker program is a across the Canada program that all Aboriginal people, most provinces have it, with the exception of Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick. They don't offer a court worker program. We in Nova Scotia have it, and our court workers' primary role is to assist clients through the process from the time they come into the court until they are completed of the court. The role is not to provide legal advice. Majority of the time, what the court workers do is to ensure that they have a lawyer and may help them to fill out the legal aid form to access a lawyer that way. They are there to answer questions about the process. What is their responsibilities? When do they need to show up for court? What does that mean when the judge says this? What do they, when is it appropriate for them to ask questions? And so what we do know is that court workers are quite successful in ensuring that the Aboriginal people of all of Nova Scotia know they're there, because we dealt with 823 different cases in the year of 2007-2008. And that's all across this province. Those cases, unfortunately, majority of the charges, as we had elaborated earlier, was regarding just administration of justice breaches, not showing up for court when they're supposed to. And like I said earlier, can be a financial and social, certainly something that they struggle with in their communities. As Barry was referencing earlier, a lot of the communities are isolated, and so it can make it difficult for them to get there.
Excuse me. Okay, Dave, there's one project, MLSN in Nova Scotia Community College, are working on, is Mi'kmaq Court Interpreters Program. For the last 2 weeks, I've been trying to recruit Mi'kmaq speakers or Mi'kmaq court worker interpreters. So my travel throughout Cape Breton, I have recruited about 28 people that are interested in taking the 13-week program, which will be introducing paralegal, cultural, language. What we have problems with is that a lot of our clients don't understand English. And majority of them are from Cape Breton area. For example, Esquizoni, Waikawego, Mawamitku. We were trying to, in 15 years ago, we had a project as a court interpreter or court translator, interpreter. But 15 years ago, when 10 of us, I was one of the students, 10 of us graduated, we were left out in the cold, so you would have to introduce yourself to the court system. When that started, the court system was reluctant to pay us for our services. You can be sitting there all day waiting for somebody by the end of the name of Young. You can be sitting there from morning till the afternoon, till that person came out to Young and you only translated 15 minutes. And so the justice system would only want to pay you 15 minutes for the services that you provided. Although you left your house 8 o'clock in the morning to be at court at 10 o'clock, you didn't come home till 6, but they only wanted to pay you for 15 minutes. the pay, we had a hard time trying to get it from the Nova Scotia justice system, but now it has changed. Now, you know, they have recognized service is very needed, especially in Cape Breton, where you have about 80% of speakers, Mi'kmaq speakers. And in mainland area, you have Pictolandon that still speak the language strongly. Afton, you have about 15% that still speak the language. Millbrook, you have about 5% that still speak the language. But although we still have to provide that services in order for us to provide the proper service to our Mi'kmaq people, our Mi'kmaq clients.
I have a question about restorative justice, which has happened, which is ongoing in non-Native communities around Nova Scotia, and I had never heard about it from other parts of the country. It might be just specific to here, but from what I understand, it comes from customary law. It's a tradition that comes from the Mi'kmaq people that's now being used for school systems and as an alternative to the criminal justice system, and being used in cases. And so how is this different from the customary law? And what are the differences and similarities? And tell me about that.
Well, the short answer can be quite easy in that restorative justice within non-Aboriginal communities across Canada is a program. Within Aboriginal communities, it's a way of life. It's as simple as it gets. It's how we live. Mm-hmm. And so we know we take our hats off to those who want to see how it's working well and how the Aboriginal people have been able to do it and then implement it. But for us, it's kind of like a no-brainer. It's how it's ingrained and how we know it's right. This is how it needs to be done. And so it's really quite complimentary that after how many years of being with European contact, that finally it's new age to, you know, imitate something that is really, you know, quite dear to the Aboriginal people.
It's hard to explain because you're living that part of life. It's hard to explain to a non-Native, but you're a part of that system and you live it every day. For me to tell you is like, as just Grace explained to you, it's part of your life. But to an European, it's like, it's a total strange way of approaching things. But to us, it's just part of our life. And that's how we deal with the justice system.
Do you think it's respectful, the restorative justice, or do you think it's acknowledging of the Aboriginal traditions, do you think, or not?
I think I remember speaking to an elder about that very issue, and I remember him saying to me, he said, you know, it is now time for us to teach them. They've tried to teach us since contact, and now they're figuring out finally that we have something about our ways that works. He said it's not to be insulted by. It's something to, you know, allow to happen and to feel honored. Nothing that we do, we consider owned. We don't own anything. And so if our teachings someone wants to use to help them in their lives, well, that would only, in fact, impact our lives, Aboriginal people, in a positive way. So how could we be insulted by it, is what he told me. So, mm-hmm. And that was a gentleman in Big Cove, Noel Millier.